A podcast is a very delicate thing. Know then that it is the year 2024. The known entertainment universe is ruled over by corporations and mega franchises. In this time, the most precious thing in the universe is the cult classic, loved by film audiences who have long held a prophecy that a show would come to discuss these classics. Oh yes, I almost forgot to tell you. This week, we're looking at the David Lynch sci-fi epic adaptation of the Frank Herbert novel, also known as Dune.
Greetings, cultists, and welcome to today's show. Yes, we've hopped a guild highliner and we're off to Arrakis for this one. That's right, not only are we geared up for part two of Villeneuve's Dune adaptation in cinemas now, but we're also celebrating the 40-year anniversary of what for many was the first introduction to the universe of Frank Herbert, the 1984 David Lynch adaptation. 40 years, can you believe that? Now, it's an oft-derided classic, this one, so I'm curious as to what the reaction will be as we take a deep dive into the sand to see if we can find the barest trace of appreciation for this movie. I've got my rubber sting pants on for this one, and I must say I'm looking quite lively, according to my uncle. But fear not, listeners, I'm not riding the worm alone on this one. I'm joined by a couple of fellow blue-eyed, well, I'm sure some would call them savages, but I consider them honourable travellers. First up, we've got regular Silver Screen contributor, it's Sandy.
Hi, how are y'all doing?
We're okay. How are you doing, Sandy?
Really good.
Great stuff. Are you looking forward to this one?
I'm excited to discuss this one.
Yeah. Well, it has been a little while coming. It's had its more than its fair share of delay, so hopefully it'll be a good one. And it's not just Sandy and myself here today. Also joining us on a return visit is a guest who last joined us way back on the very first Cult Classics in 2022. And she couldn't let that be her only appearance, so determined was she to talk about a movie she actually liked. It's Angela.
Hello.
How are you doing today, Ange?
I'm great, thank you.
And if you want to see what Angela subjected herself to back then, please check out the first.
I certainly hope so.
First Cult Classics episode. Well, we'll get right down to today's movie, which of course is the David Lynch 84 adaptation of Dune. Now, after the success of the Frank Herbert novel, attempts to adapt Dune into a movie production began in 1971. Throughout the 1970s, Arthur P. Jacobs, Alejandro Jodorowsky and Ridley Scott unsuccessfully tried to bring their own visions of the book to the screen. In late 1978, Italian producer Dino De Laurentiis purchased the rights to the book from Gibbons Consortium, previous holders of the license during Jodorowsky's development. De Laurentiis commissioned Herbert himself to write a new screenplay in 78. The script Herbert turned in was 175 pages long, the equivalent of nearly 3 hours of screen time. De Laurentiis then hired Ridley Scott in 79, but after spending 7 months on the project with writer Randy Wurlitzer and set designer H.R. Giger, who Scott worked with before, Scott left Dune to make Blade Runner instead, leading to De Laurentiis approaching Lynch in 81. Around that time, Lynch, after the relative success of Eraserhead and The Elephant Man, was in the midst of receiving several other directing offers, including Return of the Jedi. De Laurentiis contacted Lynch, who said he'd not heard of the book, but after reading it and loving it, his words, he met with De Laurentiis and agreed to direct the film. Lynch worked on the script for 6 months with Eric Berggren and Christopher DeVore, coming up with 2 drafts of the script before they split over creative differences. Lynch subsequently worked on another 5 drafts, initially, like Scott before him, spreading the movie into 2 parts, which was eventually condensed into a single film. Filming began in Mexico on 30th of March 83 with over 80 sets built on 16 sound stages with a crew of 1,700 and over 20,000 extras. It ran for 6 months and was allegedly plagued by production problems. It premiered in Washington, D.C. on December 3rd, 84 and was released worldwide shortly afterwards on December the 14th to mostly negative critical reviews. It eventually grossed just under $31 million by the end of its run on a final estimated production budget of between $40 and $42 million. As a result, the film was labelled a box office bomb, but later became a cult classic through TV airings and on home video. Now, Lynch's initial rough cut was allegedly over 4 hours long, of which he wanted to do a cut of almost 3 hours, but the theatrical cut ended up being only 2 hours. It was so egregious that Patrick Stewart joked every single cast member lost at least 2 scenes with the shuffle. Many scenes were later restored in extended versions, though without the consent of Lynch. Now, Lynch was originally signed on to do 2 sequels based on the Herbert novels Dune Messiah and Children of Dune, though the box office failure ensured those plans obviously never came to fruition. Although considered a financial flop, it is, ironically, the David Lynch movie to make the most money in its initial box office run and the only one to break into the top 5 in its opening weekend. Despite this, Lynch has been incredibly hard on himself as far as Dune goes, considering it the one true cinematic failure of his career. He cites the lack of final cut for the failure and was also quick to label himself a sellout for accepting the gig in the first place. He continues to regret his time on the movie, so much that to this day he refuses to publicly speak about the film in any detail and has refused numerous offers to work on a special edition. Apparently, he was at one time considering making a director's cut, had Universal not screwed him over in that also by assembling an extended television version behind his back. He since declined a chance to release the director's cut himself, claiming it would be too painful to return to. However, in an Esquire 2022 article, he did give hope to fans once more by saying that a director's cut could happen. And David Lynch's Dune is currently available to stream as well as being available on DVD and Blu-ray. So once again, I'm going to throw it over to you here in the studio. What were your first experiences on this one? It stands out to me as not something I remember in any great detail. I didn't see it at the cinema, so I must have watched it on video not long after it was released. But again, I've got no real memory of it. But aside from repeated watching and looking back on it with fondness, I've not really got any memory of the first time I watched it. So how about you? And I'm going to come to you first, Sandy. When did you first see this one?
It was like a lot of these early cult classics on HBO. Now, later, I was kind of on a Lynchian tear. I was basically watching everything he did, just about everything anyway. And kind of seeing the movie in a different light. But I will say, like, you know, a decade passes before I look at it again, and I feel differently about it every time.
Oh, cool. So that bodes well, I hope. So how about you, Angela? Have you got any particular recollections of the first time with this one?
Well, I know I definitely didn't see it in the cinema. I'm pretty sure it must have been on a TV. Yeah, I think I must have been a young teenager at the time and was completely bamboozled by it all. Just didn't understand a single thing that was going on. I mean, why Kyle MacLachlan's character had about 4 different names. It was like, what's going on here? Why is there a big floating thing in a tank that is farting things into space? Yeah, as I say, my lasting memory from, I probably only watched it that once, to be honest, until you mentioned it again for this. It was just one of total and utter confusion. Watching it again this time around, ready for this episode, I understood it more because I've seen the other version, and that explained things far better.
Fair enough. Yeah, I guess you're referring to the Villeneuve one, yeah?
Absolutely, yes.
Now, I know we've all watched this one, you know, again recently in preparation for this. So as we all know, it turns 40 this year. Have your impressions changed upon watching it? Do you think it holds up, in your opinion? I mean, it's a divisive one, both fans of the novels and moviegoers in general. So, you know, did it ever have a special place in your heart? Has it got better over time? Has it, you know, matured like a fine wine? Or
for me, it's matured like a fine wine. I'm liking it more each time I watch it and appreciating different things and maybe finding new things. Of course, that's kind of a Lynch trademark, even though I feel very bad for Lynch because I know he feels horrible about the project.
What about you, Angela?
Well, it's definitely better to me having watched it this time around. So I would say, yes, it's improved with age, but that's probably down to me improving with age as well.
So, yeah, with regards to Lynch, it is, as you were saying, Sandy, it is such a shame that he feels as bad as he does at this, because I don't think it's a bad film.
Right.
But yeah,
it wasn't his vision and him not getting the final cut. I mean, I do wonder what we would have seen.
If any listeners out there would like to know more, I can suggest Max Every's book, A Masterpiece in Disarray, David Lynch's Dune, an Oral History. It's available, you know, obviously wherever books are sold. Max is an individual. He put together a video for an original ending. Apparently there was an original ending envisaged by Lynch. He's a well-known name among movie buffs, so he knows his stuff. So I'll put a link to that book. But we're referring to Lynch with regards to, I mean, yes, we're skipping to the end, but, you know, if you're joining us on this show, I'm guessing you've seen the movie and either want some confirmation bias one way or the other. But Lynch's envisaged ending to the movie, instead of Paul causing it to rain on Arrakis, which is something Herbert himself disagreed with, Lynch's version would have ended with the camera flying into Paul's eye and entering, and I'm quoting here, a cacophony of surrealist imagery. Surprise, surprise. The Space Guild navigators we met at the beginning of the film are reduced to angelic maggots pouring from Paul's eyes. The faces of revelation appear to him in the countenances of Alia and his mother, Lady Jessica, as they in turn are submerged into the water of his dreams. And finally, at the end of it all, a glowing gold lotus flower promises serenity. The storyboards for this sequence are assembled online to give the viewer a rough approximation of what that would entail. So again, I'll post a link to that, but it is really interesting to see Lynch's original vision. I mean, I'm not sure how it would have been received, considering it was to launch a franchise, but I do love the artistry involved. And if you're a fan of Lynch, it's probably going to be more in tune with your aesthetic, as it were. I mean, let's be honest, it could hardly have been more poorly received than what we did end up with. I mean, it's Lynch, so I mean, you'll never really hear me say anything bad about the direction as such. He is quite subdued for a lot of this. I'm guessing you'll agree with me on that, Sandy. But anyone who says that you don't see Lynch in this, I think is mistaken. There are some really beautiful shots, and you see him shine through when the movie focuses on, you know, Paul's visions and the scenes in the Highliner, as I think it was you, Angela, with the farting guild members. I'm just wondering what you guys think about that.
I haven't really watched a lot of Lynch to be able to pick out certain nuances that he brings to things. But it's certainly, there's the general flavour of Lynch, if you know what I mean by that. You can tell it is a Lynch film without seeing specific items that you would say, yes, that is a definite Lynch thing.
Yeah.
I guess the general weirdness of things. Oh, it always seems like you've got to be on some kind of drug to understand half of the stuff that's going on.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it does follow Lynch that, you know, a lot of people are coming out of the cinema going, I did not get what was happening in that. But it is very subdued compared to his other work. What about you, Sandy? What do you think?
Like you mentioned, in his inner mind, those types of things, or the folding of space, the imagery that comes through there is very David Lynch. And then, like Angela said, yeah, there was like a Lynch flavor kind of undertone to the film as a whole.
There are scenes in this that I'm not particularly fond of. It's not something that you'd want to watch while eating, if you know what I mean.
I think one of those scenes is actually playing on my screen now, where you've got the doctor with the Baron.
Yes.
And he's saying, like, your face is love to me, or something like that. Your disease is love to me.
Yeah, that to me is just, obviously, the Baron is in the book, and the Baron is quite a loathsome creature, but he's very wily, very intelligent. He doesn't, I'm not going to, you know, diss Kenneth McMillan's performance in this, but he doesn't come across as shrewd as he does in the novel. But the entire thing with the boils and the heart plugs and stuff like that, that's pure Lynch.
And in fact, it was the only part of the movie that indicated we should be scared of him, because it was buffoonery the whole rest of the time. And so that seemed so important, also so disgusting.
Yeah, you needed something to show just how kind of despicable he is. And I guess, as you say, Sandy, that scene kind of illustrates that perfectly, because, as you say, there is a bit of buffoonery. And I'm thinking specifically of one scene, the bit later on, where Sting is in that kind of steam bath and he's just flying around it. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah.
I'll be honest, and this is no disrespect to you, Sandy, I am much less impressed with the opening narration and the expositional choices throughout the movie. It seems, I don't know what you thought, but to me it seemed to take a more prominent role in the, say, I would say the latter half of the movie, to the point it becomes obtrusive. It starts repeating quite a lot, but I can see that as more down to studio interference and what resulted from them cutting the movie, because, as I said, apparently, you know, it was 3 hours long, and De Laurentiis and co told Lynch, no, we want this 2 hours, so they had to remove just so much that it became almost impossible to get by without some kind of narration giving exposition as to just what was going on. And I think one of the scenes that suffers most from is the montage later on, where they're on about how, I think it was in the, where she says, in the four standard years that followed, and it just shows clips of Raban running up hills and things blowing up.
Like you said, it was because so much was cut and they needed to connect the pieces. However, occasionally that exposition would enlighten and let you know how much detail, because what I appreciate about science fiction is making it seem possible, making it seem realistic. And so, like, there was one part where Paul was saying something about the suspension field will make the hunter seeker slippery on the bottom. And I thought that was great. You know, just that one part, that is an internal monologue I would have appreciated, instead of all of the things that was like, yeah, I know, I'm not stupid, I understand what's happening here.
Yeah. Especially when it starts repeating itself a lot later on, and you just say, okay, we get the point now. And I
things that should have been conveyed through the acting instead of, show, don't tell, like we always refer back to.
And this is what gets me about the movie as it stands. They obviously cut it down and gave it a particular ending to round it off. And then, but then it goes on to say there were going to be two more sequels based on, obviously, Dune Messiah and Children of Dune. But this has ended with such a finality. It kind of makes me think that they'd already planned that this was not going anywhere, if that makes sense to you guys.
I think I had read, as someone mentioned, like, what need do we have for any sequels? Everything's already solved.
Yeah.
That's it. How it came across to me watching it is, obviously, they got to the end where Paul's there controlling the sandworms. He's got the whole army behind him. And then all of a sudden, all these aspects of his supposed messiahhood sort of fall into place immediately. The skies open, all the rain comes down, despite the fact that they've had like billions of gallons of water hidden underneath anyway. It was just like all these different things all sort of mashed together to say, right, that's it. He's done his job. That's it. Off we go. I think if they might have actually started filming some of the stuff for the sequel, and when they decided they weren't going to do one, just took that bit and just mashed it all together for the ending.
Yeah, because there's no development at all. Once they go into the desert, it's from there, it is, like Angela said, just mashed together. I think that's a part where people really fall off, because, you know, all of a sudden, they had one fight. Oh, you showed great strength. I will now call you this, you know, and he just didn't earn it. He didn't earn that woman's love. He didn't earn these people's respect. And it was almost an afterthought. The whole back half of the film is where I start to love the first half, and I start to hate the second half. And like you said, though, I think that's what a lot of novel purists talk about too, the end, that the rain comes, and that was just totally antithetical to the whole message of the book.
But yeah, with regards to the rain, I had to include this. One of the Dune groups on Facebook a little while ago were talking about the ending, and I have to list this. Someone responded, Lucia Smatanova, I apologize if I mispronounced that. But her response to the ending was, maybe he got too immersed by the Toto soundtrack and actually wanted to bring the reins to Africa. And I just thought that was fantastic. So thank you for that, Lucia. The writing. I just, there is so much that is missing, and I can't really comment on the writing as such, because of the studio interference, we don't know how much was removed. I mean, that thing that you were referring to, Sandy, about they instantly follow him. I've seen the extended TV version, and he does have that fight with one of the Fremen. And for them to just cut that out, it's completely baffling to me. Because as you say, one minute there, you know, we'll take him. The next minute, he runs up a cliff. She grabs Stilgar by the throat, and he says, oh, you're so strong. And then the next thing, they're all part of this happy little tribe, if you know what I mean. None of it feels earned in this version.
Yeah. There do seem to be quite a few things where things occur without a logical explanation of why they are doing these things, which, as you say, is probably from the editing.
Yeah, it makes it a hard one to judge, because there's an awful lot of world building goes on in the first half. And then it also does, as you said, seem like the second half's just an afterthought.
I think they're actually using the term Kwisatz Haderach quite literally, shortening of the way.
Ah.
Is how it literally translates from the old Tchaikovsky, apparently. So, yes, I have been doing my homework. yeah. It looks like they got halfway through and decided they just needed to shorten the rest of it and cut a lot out. And there we go. We've gone from A to Z without going through B through to Y. If you see what I mean. Yeah.
I've mentioned Toto. So we might as well go there. I mean, I don't know what you think to it, but to me, it shouldn't work at all. And in some aspects, it doesn't. But because of this, it goes right around and suits it perfectly to me for most of its runtime. It's a really weird one. What did you guys think to the soundtrack with regards to this one?
I didn't realise until watching it this second time around that it was Toto on the soundtrack, which, considering that I'm like a rock and metal person, I ought to have known. I don't know. It does seem to fit, weirdly enough.
I think it works also because it doesn't sound like Toto. It does sound like a film score, and there's this underlying, you know, there's just, it's a different type of strings. It's guitar instead of violin or what have you, but it does work for me also.
Yeah. I should also point out that it's not just Toto. There's some Brian Eno in there in the prophecy theme. Yeah.
It was very subtle. I think the way that it sort of blended in, it does work, but like you say, it's not like them singing, it's just
instrumental vocals. Yeah.
Going back to the cut scenes, and what Patrick Stewart said, that everybody lost at least two scenes. Patrick Stewart was apparently the wrong hire for this. Lynch, he wanted Patrick Stewart, though apparently he wanted a different Patrick Stewart. Lynch thought he was hiring some guy from a play that he'd seen. He played Henry IV in a London matinee of the same name. And Lynch and company had kind of fallen in love with him, seen him backstage in costume. So they invited him, and then Patrick Stewart turned up at Lynch's hotel to meet him. And apparently was rather eagerly, as Stewart already knew of Lynch and admired him for his work. Lynch had no clue who he was. But at that point, it was just far too late to go and look for someone else. So Patrick Stewart ended up with the role of Gurney.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Me neither. But I didn't feel he looked out of place or anything.
I think he's one of the strongest in this. I mean, you don't see him a lot, but... You know, the guy's carrying a pug at one point. You can't, you know, he's heading into battle with a pug in his arms. You just can't fault that kind of shit.
Now, I was quite amused when he was raising his voice during the combat training and you could hear the Yorkshire accent come out.
Yes, yes.
That made me smile quite a bit. But no, I do agree. You know, he is definitely one of the stronger performers.
Yeah. I mean, the acting... To me, the acting often gets derided in this. I think for the most part, it's perfectly adequate. Some are obviously better than others. I think what happens is when you have actors of a certain caliber and they're mixing with other actors that are, for want of a better term, used to just working behind the camera, haven't been as experienced in stage work, it kind of has an off balance. I don't know what you think with regards to this.
I think you might have something there. There are obviously people that are more professional, that learn all the lines and learn to emote, you know, in a grand way. And then there are others that, like you say, that have just been in front of cameras who can take billions of takes and they just like take it easy because they know it could be fixed in editing. Whereas there are others that you can tell they're trying to nail it first time.
Yeah. There are some really fantastic actors in this. I mean, Brad Dourif is pretty much excellent in everything. Lynch continued to work with, you know, people like Jack Nance, Everett McGill, Dean Stockwell, Jürgen, Alicia Witt. There are some really good actors in this. Is there anyone that you felt, either of you felt notable? In that respect, that you thought, yeah, this is, you know, this is some good stuff.
Jürgen Prochnow definitely had some gravitas. You know, he definitely brought the right feel to the role, you know, being very grand. And people like Jürgen, as I say, definitely lived the role.
Yeah. Again, it's a shame that you didn't see much of him and you wonder just how much of his presence was cut. And when you're trimming scenes with actors at that caliber, I think you're already on a downward trajectory. Conversely, is there anyone in this that you just could not take seriously?
Well, certainly the first time around, I couldn't take Sting seriously. I've just seen him in The Police, you know, like and then is there with like spiky orange hair and in rubber underpants. It's just like, what? I don't mean that I thought Singh was a bad actor. He was, you know, does act really well in this, and I've seen him act in other things. Not being able to take him seriously is because, as I say, I'd previously only seen him doing his musician, you know, stuff.
It must have been jarring back in the day. I don't remember seeing that part. But now that there's been so much time and Sting looks so much different now, it's easier to see him as almost like this kind of, you know, steampunk space freak. It was easier for me to see him as that.
And he does, let's be fair, he does chew the scenery a little, but I think that's more down to the character than any lack of ability on his part.
I think so too.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, I do, as much as he is buffoonish, because we brought it up early, I do like Kenneth McMillan for the Baron in this. You can love him, you can hate him, but I do think he stands, to me at least, he stands up as more of a presence than Skarsgård does in the Villeneuve version.
Yeah, you're right. Because he's just so unhinged.
Yeah, I think in the Lynch version is definitely more of a larger than life character. He's very much in your face. Whereas, as you say, Skarsgård, it's more subtle and less repulsive.
Yeah.
When you said, oh, do you want to talk about the original Dune? I immediately thought of the Baron, and it was like, do I really want to see that again? But okay, it might not be as bad as I remembered. Not as bad as I remembered, but still pretty.
With regards to the acting itself, several people were considered for Princess Irulan, amongst them people like Meg Ryan, Michelle Pfeiffer, Melanie Griffith. God knows what that would have been like. Apparently Helena Bonham Carter was actually cast, but she had to pull out due to a scheduling conflict, and that's why we got Virginia Madsen. I think Virginia Madsen is seriously underused in this, other than that stunning bit of opening narration.
At least in the end cut. But clearly, he cast this person strictly for the opening sequence, because in all those names you've mentioned, they all have striking facial, especially cheek bone structure to their face, or striking jaw lines, and which really like that open narration. The only problem I had with the open narration was the face fading in and out against the starry background. That was annoying to me, but it was visually appealing.
Yeah. Well, that brings us neatly into the production design, which to me is by far the best thing about this movie. I don't know what you two think of with regards to this. Everything else kind of, you know, sometimes it's okay, sometimes it's not, depending on my mood. But from this, I always, if I'm reading the novels, I always read it in my mind's eye with this kind of set design and, you know, these kind of models and stuff like that. Maybe not the Ornithopters as such, but what do you guys think of that?
That was one of my first notes, actually, when I started watching it again. It's like the sets were very elaborate. You could tell that a lot of the money for the film had gone into just the stage sets. Absolutely beautiful.
I loved the sets, and it felt practical. It didn't feel like it was just meant to be a sci-fi spectacle. Like I felt the sets felt very practical.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little steampunk, but I can't deny there's some really big ideas in there. It may not be in in your face or out there as the designs for Jodorowsky's adaptation would have been. But to me, there's a consistency to the design that works. I mean, there's a distinct style between Arrakis, the Emperor's throne room, which you've said it's quite ostentatious, the House Atreides, House Harkonnen. And Harkonnen is, to me, in some regards, almost, I don't know what you guys think, maybe it's different perception, but it's to me, Gedi Prime is almost what Hell would look like on, you know, with its industrial feel.
And there's a sickly green color everywhere, yeah.
Yeah, you do come away, though, feeling that they are at least all part of the same universe. And I do like that. There's a consistency to the design, real, you know.
The costumes as well, I think, really match the individual characters. Excellent tailoring, putting, you know, into things like the still suits, the military regalia.
I love the still suits too. Also, not just the design, but the concept of what they do, how they do it. Of course, they would have that. I love that bit of world building, which is probably more a tribute to the book. I don't know for certain, but I do. I did love those.
Yeah, I mean, with regards to the speaking about, you know, how it looks. I mean, for the most part, I think the special effects kind of hold up. Some of the sandworms are starting to look a little rubbery. There's the odd thing that doesn't hold up, the painted guild highliners, when the Baron gets killed and sucked out into the outside, and the ship where it's carrying Paul and Jessica, where they're kidnapped, and the Harkonnens are flying them out to the desert. It looks a little classic Doctor Who. To me, for the most part, especially for a 40-year-old movie, to me, a lot of this still looks good. With regards to the production design, one thing I did forget to mention, the guild members' costumes, you know, the black long things that they walk in, and they're carrying that old BBC microphone.
Yeah.
They weren't actually designed for the movie. They were actual real-life body bags from the 1920s. They'd been found in an abandoned warehouse by the production team. So they just did them up a bit and then used them. Lynch and his assistants didn't tell the actors that these body bags had been used several times prior until production wrapped.
Oh!
Bad form, as they say across the pond. Bad form.
Yeah, I just thought I'd throw that out there. So, is there anything that you guys think that was notable that you don't think we've touched upon?
Just the sound design throughout, I really appreciated something I touched on in the beginning, but it almost seemed like David Lynch was not only trying to present a visual feast, but like purposely, it wasn't just adding to the movie. The sound was very much also a purpose of the movie. Like that very first scene of the worm eating the mining platform and the Dune music playing and the sound of the worm just like opening his maw and engulfing the platform. I just thought that was really, really awesome. And then carried throughout. In fact, sound design was one of the things they were nominated for an Oscar, I think. They didn't win. And I'm wondering who did now. I want to go back and look at who beat that. But I thought the sound design was very good. And especially thinking about sound effects for the time, it doesn't sound like an 80s sci-fi movie. And it probably helped that there weren't lasers shooting and stuff like that. I just thought the sound design was incredible and noteworthy.
Yeah, I think Lynch will have, I mean, I don't think he's obviously credited as a sound design, but I do know that he takes quite an active part in the sound design because a lot of his films rely on it to create mood.
I think one thing that maybe people don't appreciate quite so much from this is just how much influence it has on artists and just general social media, you know, ever since, because I don't know how many of the listeners might have heard the Fatboy Slim song.
Weapon of choice. Yeah.
With Christopher Walken dancing in it. Because there's the line, when you walk without rhythm and you won't attract the worm, which is obviously a direct quote.
I did not ever pick up on that.
You'll have to watch it back now. So yes, there's that. And then another one, which is probably more recent, is certainly for millennials. The quote, obviously, "He who controls the spice controls the universe," has been updated to, "He who controls the pumpkin spice controls the white girls."
Oh. Oh, man. So it's still there in the public consciousness, even though no one likes to admit it.
Yeah.
Something that we've been asking audiences, we started, I don't know if we started last year, but we've certainly been asking it this year. Do you think it deserves its cult classic status?
Yeah, it's one of those that obviously it grows on you the more you watch it and the more you become to understand it. Underappreciated at its time. Yes, you can see the joins now and things like that. It maybe doesn't stand up quite so much with the visual effects and what have you these days. But then again, what does nowadays with technology moving on so fast? You can basically see the editing everywhere now, the blue screens and whatnot. I would say it is definitely a cult classic.
What about you, Sandy? Do you think it deserves its status?
I think it's almost like exactly what a cult classic is supposed to be. Just parts horrible and wonderful all at the same time. And there's also just with its source material, it's almost, it's only for the people who are serious about the genre almost. It's almost got a bit of an elitist, untouchable feel to the film on one hand, or at least to the source material, you know, on one hand. And then on the other hand, just really trashed for, you know, it's the finished product. And I think that's part of its staying power is because of the source material, that it is so well loved and that it was the first real and heartfelt adaptation of the source material. Lynch just did something so ambitious, and it, because of that, because he did do it, it deserves that cult classic status. Because it's a film that not everybody can love. And in fact, even people who love it, like we, I think, talked more about its negative qualities than its positive qualities, because there's just so much to talk about there.
Yeah. Cool. While we're here, we'll go around and give our little favorites, if we have any, from this movie. Like a favorite part of the movie, such as a piece of dialogue or a scene, direction, anything in particular. And I'll stick with you for this one, Sandy. Do you have any particular favorite?
The part of the movie that made me slow down and really listen was right before they were about to travel to Arrakis, and they're kind of just watching the waves for the last time on Caladan. And the dude tells Paul, "But a person needs new experiences. They jar something deep inside, allowing him to grow. Without change, something sleeps inside us and seldom awakens." And I really, that part spoke to me. And it did become a theme throughout the film of Paul kind of, you know, "I'm awake now." Just kind of going through that learning experience and turning into this prophesized one. But for me personally, just in life, it can be so easy to get trapped in the mundane minutiae of everyday life that I even myself purposefully do something I would that's out side of my own character, because I am such an introvert and I do love being home. And every now and then I'll go do something out of the ordinary, and it really does add spice back into my life and kind of wake me up a little bit and shake my perspective. And I just thought that was so important. And I that part of the movie specifically there in the very beginning spoke to me.
Fantastic. What about you, Angela?
For me, the scene that resonates the most, I think, is where Paul has to put his hand in the box with the Bene Gesserit witch. And the whole mantra of "I must not fear, fear is the mind killer." Because I am one of those people where I can be so scared of doing certain things. But if it's something I really want to do or somewhere I really want to go, I will do what I can to overcome that fear and do it anyway. And that mantra there is sort of like, yeah, words to live by.
I love the scene where he takes the water of life, not the scene itself, but I love the vision he has at that point. To me, it's the most Lynchian aspect of this film. That, I mean, he does it in all the dream sequence, but that one particularly. And it does have that, you know, that whole space worms farting section, but there's a part where it's going down that channel, which you know, you assume is in the Guild Highliner. It almost looks like a city, as if you're traveling along the base of it. And it's got Paul's voice in the background saying, and he says, "And I have the power to destroy the spice forever." I just think there's something about the juxtaposition of the audio on that and the visuals, and it just moves me every time. I love that. So fantastic. So as per the norm, we'll give our final scores in a moment. Before that, as is customary, we'll go over to you out there for what you think of this one with our audience participation section. And wow, just wow. I may have been impressed with last year's response to Halloween 3, but even that paled in comparison to the sheer amount of feedback we received for this one. I mean, it was so much that after just one day, I had to turn off comments. Such was the overwhelming response. It provoked a lot of feelings, many opinions on both sides for this one. Isn't that right, Sandy?
Yes, there was tons of thoughts and opinions on this one, really across the spectrum.
I imagine you had your plate full collating this.
Indeed. In fact, I know some people are going to be looked over. Sorry for that.
It can't be helped. The just the amount alone. So, yeah. Once again, you know, I will say, if we don't read it, please don't be disappointed. We do read every single one of them. It's just strictly down to time. So, without further ado, I'll hand it over to you, Sandy.
All right. We are going to start off here. Michael Moore, and I hope not the Michael Moore, he says, whatever your opinion, you must realize that the technology was not what we have now. This placed a lot of limits on what could be adapted from the book for the big screen. However, it introduced a lot of people to the books and helped the fan base grow. Without the 1984 film, there would be a lot less interest in the book, and the new version of Dune would not even exist. Clive Stonebridge said, "It's flawed, but there are bits I adore. The soundtrack, the set design, costumes, etc. I'd still rank it 4 out of 5. Lee Burns, we need to give voice to these opinions as well. He said he would give it less than 0. Bad acting, overacting, idiotic sound blasters, battle pugs, cats, rats, eyebrows, and spice maggots capable of chewing space. Oh, those eyebrows, they were magnificent. Given the difficulty of the source material, Richard Cave says certainly 3 out of 5, maybe even 4 out of 5. It has a certain vision and runs with it and makes a memorable film, which is compelling at turns and, of course, questionable at others. Christine Byrne, another one that had negative feelings towards it, 1 out of 5 stars. It was an insult to Dune. The weirding modules, he didn't know how to show they were trained well. They had to rely on a machine. The only way he could have figured out how to show how evil the Baron was to have him enjoying shots in pustules on his face. And then The Rain at the end, Kyle MacLachlan was miscast, too old, but Patrick Stewart was brilliant. John Patton said, it's a great bad movie, always fun to watch. Matt May said, the Guildman's visit to the Emperor is not in the book, but clearly something like that had to have happened, and I think it was a great scene. And I don't see how you can beat Sting's performance. Randall Watkins says, it's great. It's not for everyone, but it's great. I love how Lynch depicted the Harkonnen, dark and deprived. I enjoyed the new movie, but I doubt we'll ever get something so delicious from it as when Peter hocked a loogie onto Jessica's face. That was horrible. Toby Cocker says, it definitely grows on you over time, and it was good enough to spawn the video games. If you never saw, you definitely need to read the book first before watching this one. Sam Carter, one of the few ones we hear of that can tell us what it was like to see it back in the day, he gave it, Sam Carter, a 5 out of 5. My mom took me to watch it when I was a 12-year-old, then grabbed my arm and promptly walked out during the Baron's boil popping scene. But my young brain had already hooked into the Dune universe, and it had a big impact on me. And 38 years later, I'm still a Dune freak. So that's my personal reason for having so much love for the original. Randy Brown says, the theatrical version is rough, but there's a lot of potential with striking visuals and smart shortcuts. The 4.5-hour cut, which has never been released but was aired once on TV, is quite good. Fans still have to grapple with the changes, but the story and characters are well realized. I have no idea why this version isn't available to purchase. This one, I'll end on this one. I appreciated how he parsed this out, but Zoltan Neri, he says, as a Lynch movie, 4 out of 5, messed up. Could be Lynch couldn't do more, but it is enough to be a good, fun Lynch movie. But as a Dune movie, 2 out of 5. Some of the themes are there, but neither the technology nor the pacing nor the script was strong enough to handle it. The thing that it's just skips months of events and Abomination Child is just unbelievable. Again, as a Lynch movie, great. As a Dune movie, mostly garbage. And so we will end on that one there.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that this one divides opinions. It's certainly not as clear cut as others we've had on the show. So yeah, again, thank you to everyone out there for being kind enough to share your thoughts with us. And again, I'm sorry if you didn't hear your name on this one, but please share your thoughts on future episodes. You can always leave your comments for others to read below if you're watching this on YouTube or on our social media if you think there's something we've missed and want to get it off your chest. We do love seeing your interactions as always, so please do keep them coming. So now we know what you out there think, it's time for us to give our final thoughts on this one and our score. So I'm coming to you first, Angela. When it all comes down to it, what are your thoughts on Dune 84?
Well, if you'd have asked me when I first saw it to give it out at 5 rating, I would have given it one star out of 5. Having watched it again and being able to understand it more, and to sort of watch it from an adult rather than a child's perspective, I would now give it a 3 out of 5, because yeah, there are some things that I just can't get over, certainly at the moment, but it wasn't all bad.
That's fair. How about you, Sandy? Final thoughts on this one?
I feel very similarly. And this is a film that grows on me more and more each time I see it. But I also give it a 3, and I feel it's the studio's fault. I give Lynch like a 5 out of 5 for the ambition he took. But the film itself, I do also have to give it a reluctant 3.
That's fair enough. I'm going to give it, well, I'm going to say, is it a great adaptation? No. Is it a good movie in its own right? Also, no. Is it a great Lynch movie? Not really. But despite all this, I do have a fondness for it.
Where are we going with this?
Yeah. It introduced me to both the world of Dune and to David Lynch movies. So at the end of the day, I can't complain. It's a misfire in so many ways. But there's just enough to keep me returning to this one every few years. Some of the performances are decent enough. Some of the effects, well done. But it's only some in both cases. Where this works for me is the production design. And it's a look I still associate with the universe all these years later. So, yeah, I'm going to give it 3.5 out of 5. Which, working it out, gives... Oh, it's one of your kind of scores, Sandy. It gives the final score for David Lynch a 3.1 out of 5. So, fair assessment, do you think? I think. I reckon so. I mean, it's close to you guys more than it is mine. And considering how divisive this one is, I think that's done quite well, to be honest. It's certainly not the lowest we've ranked here on Cult Classics, let alone Silver Screen.
I think it's definitely one of the Marmite movies out there. You either love it or hate it.
That's true. Yeah. What about you, Sandy?
I feel it's a true rating. I feel it's a true rating that it's even true for all of our audience interaction, too. It feels like a very true, good... Cool. Feels like a very good, solid score there.
Nice one. I mean, I do think it's a testament to how... Well, I mean, it's not perfect, nor is it a best adaptation. But, I mean, it is 40 years old. And we are still talking about it. And for the most part, in a semi-positive light, and, you know, that's more than you can say about many tentpole blockbusters from the last few years. So it's, I mean, it stood the test of time and thumbed its nose at many of its detractors from when it was released, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I gave it a 3, but I really like it.
So, yeah, that's it for this epic show. So that's kind of apt considering the film we're talking about. So all that's left to do is to thank my guests for today for joining me. So, Angela, Sandy, thank you for being here today. I know the delay didn't help, but hopefully it's allowed us to get some decent discussion and maybe have some stuff in there that wouldn't have been had it gone ahead on time.
I appreciate everything. Yeah, and so happy to speak with Angela. So nice.
Thank you for inviting me back. Nice speaking with you, Sandy. You've definitely brought a more cerebral, philosophical aspect to it, you know, delving further into it than I expected, for me to go at least. I was just looking at the basics, and you've just brought a whole new description of the film.
That's how I roll.
So Angela, you're kind of, this is your second appearance, you're now an old hat at this thing, so you know the drill. Anything you'd like to plug while you're here, any social media links you'd like to put out?
Not really. I mean, those of you who know what I'm into will have probably be following me anyway, but if there are any Rammstein fans out there, come and say hi. I'm Rammstein for Immer on Twitter, as I refuse to call it X. And you'll find me also on Facebook and Instagram. Yes.
Cool.
Okay. Thank you.
And what about you, Sandy? Anywhere people can find you? Have you got your plans up and running yet, or are you still clinging onto that antisocial vibe?
That one. But I am definitely thinking about planning. Maybe I'll have something in 4, 8, 15, 16, 23, 42 months. I don't know.
Fair enough. Brilliant. As for you out there, if you want to get in touch to discuss today's show or volunteer for a guest spot on a future episode, then please drop us a line through the usual channels. You can also contribute to our Ko-fi link if you want to help out. And as always, we do appreciate a like and subscribe should you wish it. I could go through the usual spiel about what's up next, but that would spoil the surprise. I'll just say, be here Tuesday of next month to find us in our usual spot while we're discussing another cult classic. And in the meantime, you can find one or more of us on the regular Silver Screen show or the Hit and Miss Star Trek podcast. So in true Universal Pictures fashion, I'll race to the end by saying, where there was war, Silver Screen would bring peace. Where there was hate, Silver Screen would bring love. And how can that be? For this is the Cult Classics Podcast. Good night, all.
You have been listening to the Cult Classics Show, part of the Silver Screen Podcast, created, written, and hosted by TK. Produced by Mike Wilson. Editing by Nick. Feedback section produced by Sandy Evanson. Opening credits by Ian Sanderson. music by Timeless Journey. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found on our link tree. This podcast is part of the Mike's Podcast Network, available wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Silver Screen Podcast or Mike's Podcasts. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. Thank you for joining us. We hope to see you next time. And remember, no matter where you go, there you are.